Welcome back to the G-Fly and Dixie podcast, brought to you by our presenting partner, Simplicity Group, featuring Big Ten Network, ESPN, and Inside Lacrosse analyst, and my Blue Jay brother, Mark Dixon. I'm your host, Dan Flynn. Dix, it's quarterfinals week. Our friend Christian Sweezy will be back to talk about lacrosse and life as our guest analyst, and we'll break down all four quarterfinal games to get you ready for this weekend. A lot to talk about, Dix, so let's get it. Dixie, what's good? Good weekend in Chapel Hill?
It was a great weekend in Chapel Hill. Great weather. The game itself that I called with Mike Murphy, Carolina U Albany, wasn't super competitive, but it's always great to see Scott Maher and what he brings to the table, not just as a lacrosse coach, but just as a human being. I have to admit, he had us believing on our production call last Thursday. I mean, the way he talks about his team and all the pretty well documented his relationship coaching Liam Gleason and everything that transpired since Liam Gleason's death. But Scott shared with us, I mean, they've had about a half dozen to a dozen other tragedies, you know, folks passing away associated with the U Albany program. And, you know, so it's been a really rough road for them emotionally. And the other thing that we talked about during the broadcast was after COVID, Scott was ready to hang it up. I mean, he was just fed up with just everything, you know, and kind of thought it was time. And the class that is graduating in 2026, headlined by Silas Richmond, really reignited his love for the game. And he had a couple other players. Jake Pisano was one that really kind of reset the culture. And so it was cool listening to him talk about that. But it was great weather. It was graduation weekend, so everything was packed. Franklin Street was bumping, but it was fun. And now we turn the page. I see you have your Johns Hopkins Blue Jay shirt on, which good for you, but you don't have the Nag Blue Jay, which is very disappointing to someone old school like myself. But you do you. What is that name for the birds? The
ornithologically correct.
What is it called?
Ornithologically correct.
There you go. That's the one you have. You have the you're the corporate. You got the corporate Blue Jay.
This is the redesigned bird. What are you talking about? Like, you know, there's the Nag, the Neil Grauer. It's kind of looks a little bit like Woody Woodpecker. There's some copyright infringement possibilities on that.
No. It's classic.
It is classic. I love it. The university needed a primary mark.
Yeah.
In the late 90s, I think they made the switch, or early 2000s. Early 2000s, probably. And that's what I'm wearing. And I was shocked by the Blue Jays. What a Saturday afternoon for your boy over here. I was enjoying that one. That was a great win for the Jays. We'll talk about that. Let's bring in a man who was at that game, Dixie. Our old friend, longtime friend of the pod, Christian Sweezy, is our guest analyst. Christian has been covering the sport of lacrosse and writing about it since 1991. He's been with Inside Lacrosse since 2003, and he's the author of two books, We Showed Baltimore, and a brand new one that listeners can get right now out in hardcover called The Long Red Line. Christian, how are you doing?
I'm very well and very excited to be back with you guys. And I love the Neil Grauer Blue Jay, for the record. I'm with Dixie on this one.
I love it too. Don't get me wrong. But the way that they make the shirts now, it's not on everything.
If Dan Flynn was a pro wrestler, he'd be a lackey for Mr. McMahon. He'd be part of the corporate clique versus Stone Cold Steve Austin, which is what I stand for. And you too, Christian, by the way.
Thank you. Yes. We're James Caan and Rollerball. That's what we're, the individualists.
I don't remember that role from James Caan, but I'm gonna go with it.
So, Sweezy, you were in Ithaca, New York this weekend covering that game.
Yes.
And I loved your article this week on Inside Lacrosse about, you know, the things that happen behind the scenes that can really make a difference in terms of travel and all the accommodations, things like that, that can alter or give you success in the NCAA tournament. And tell me more about your trip to Ithaca and some of the behind-the-scenes things.
First of all, thank you for having me. I love being on the pod with you guys. Secondly, about the trip itself, you know, coming from D.C., it's not as far as I remember. Like, I need to do that trip more often. I still love Schoolcraft Field. You know, there's still sort of a magic to it because it's a little bit like Franklin Field or Homewood Field. Even I think Homewood might actually even be older than Schoolcraft. But, you know, you get into you see that clamshell kind of stance in the background. You can just close your eyes and say, oh, yeah, Mike French played here and Amon played here and McEnany. And just that long history, and it hasn't really changed all that much. So I like being there. So I like that part of it. And the game itself was so interesting because I kind of thought Cornell was going to win. And it certainly at 5-3 with just a few seconds left in the first half, and they score that slam dunk on extra man to make it 6-3. I said, oh, okay. I think they're just about there. And Johns Hopkins in that third quarter, the defense, and the whole game, I thought the defense, but that third quarter in particular, Cornell only took 3 shots and none on target. And so Johns Hopkins won a playoff game on the road with a goalie who made 3 saves and winning less than 50% of their faceoffs. It's just so impressive. And the behind the scenes things, I was so, you know, the Statler is a nice hotel and those are not free rooms. They don't give them away. And I was so impressed by the buy-in from Johns Hopkins to make that move and say, no, you know what? It's important for us to eat as a team. It's important for us to do these things as a team and not just, I think that the previous hotel where they were booked had a size that could fit maybe up to 40 people and that wasn't going to fit their travel party. And they said, no, that's not good enough. We're going to find our own thing. And they did. And I was terribly impressed by how they did that.
And they found those accommodations on Friday once they were in Ithaca. They found 30 plus rooms.
With a NASCAR event at Watkins Glen, which is less than an hour from Ithaca. Yes, it did.
So you're back in Ithaca, and you have a new book out, The Long Red Line. Tell us more about that.
It is about the 2025 season when Cornell won its first national title in 48 years. It is also about the 48-year stretch and sort of some of the things that happened, you know, because they were sort of snake bit, and they do have a rather rabid following, and that is part of the book as well. Some, you know, almost like a, I'm not going to say it's like the Grateful Dead or like Fish, but it's a little, for lacrosse purposes, it's similar. These are people who were serious and they follow the team and they don't really follow a whole lot of other sports, just Cornell lacrosse. And then also the role that George Boyardi continues to play in that program. He died on Schoolcraft Field during a game, blocking a shot because they were only ahead by 3 goals and he was the ultimate team player. He said, I don't need this shot to go through because if it goes in, then we're in trouble. And he jumped in front of the shot and died. March 17th, 2004. So the role that he plays, but also it's a little bit wider. I didn't want to make it just sort of Cornell, Cornell, Cornell. It's a little bit wider on, you remember, in 2024, Cornell did not make the NCAA tournament. And then the next year, they win the whole thing. So how do they turn that around? And, you know, the stuff of George Boyardi is not proprietary to Cornell. Anyone could borrow these. You remember, he was a long stick at Landon, went to Cornell, and they said, oh, you have to play short stick. Okay. I'll play short stick, you know, and just sort of little things that he did to be the ultimate team player, a lot of which is in The Hard Hat by John Gordon, an excellent book that I recommend. This is more a little bit about George's background and what he was like at Landon and what it was like for him at Cornell and just the very tangible ways that they continue to honor his memory. And remember, he wore jersey 21, and last year it was 21 years since he died, and they won their first title since 77.
Fitting and poetic. Where can people find your book?
They can find it at Cornell Press. They can find it at Amazon. They can find it at Barnes & Noble. And they can find it in the trunk of my car if they happen to see me driving around Old Town Alexandria.
Is that the same car you drove to Ithaca?
No. No. Actually, we had a nicer car to get to Ithaca and back. We had the Statler Hotel of cars to get to Ithaca and back. My car was more like where Hopkins originally was booked.
Okay. Nice. All right. There's 4 great quarterfinal games that have a lot of meat and interesting things to get to. We can talk about some of the results of last week as we talk about the games this week. So let's get on to the game previews. A reminder, the D-Fly and Dixie podcast is brought to you by our presenting partner, Simplicity Group. Simplicity Group is a leading financial products distribution firm that specializes in providing best-in-class insurance, investment, and business development solutions. To learn more, visit simplicitygroup.com. All right, there are 2 games each day. One starts at noon. The second game comes on after at 2:30, roughly. If the first game goes a little longer, they always give them, you know, at least 30 minutes to warm up. Saturday's games are in Hempstead, New York at Hofstra's James M. Schuert Stadium. Sunday's games are at Delaware Stadium in Newark, Delaware. We'll start with Saturday's noon game, which features the Johns Hopkins Blue Jays, who are 10-5, against the number 2 seed Notre Dame Fighting Irish, who are 11-2 on the season, ranked number 1 for a good portion of the year. This game can be seen on ESPNU. Notre Dame is a 2.5-point favorite, which is the biggest spread of the entire weekend right now. So we expect some close games. This is the eighth all-time meeting between these schools, and they've all been in May in the NCAA tournament. The last was in 2023 in the quarterfinals when Notre Dame won 12-9. Dixie, your thoughts on this first game of the weekend?
I played in the very first meeting between Hopkins and Notre Dame, 1992 NCAA first round. At home.
I was there at Homewood.
Yeah. So we won that day, and I can still remember Notre Dame, who they have to beat to go to their first championship weekend. It was Hopkins back in 2001 with Captain Kirk Howe in goal for the Fighting Irish. So this is an improbable matchup. Peter Milliman is a coach who I think had been fired maybe a half dozen times this season. Definitely halftime of the Virginia game. Then probably halftime or in the third quarter of the Penn State game in the regular season. And then maybe somewhere in the Ohio State meeting later that year, among others. And they just continue to find ways to win. And they did it this past weekend without Quentin Kilrain. Luke Martin played an unbelievable game. So I really didn't get a chance to watch this game while it was unfolding. My wife and I were with our son Owen down in Chapel Hill, having some food, having some drinks. And well, we went to a place called the Crunkleton. You guys familiar with the Crunkleton on Franklin Street? It is like an old, like speakeasy, fancy kind of, you know, all they have is booze. And they had two TVs, and one had on a golf event. And I said, "Oh," and I asked the bartenders to change. They're like, they're not gonna do that. I went to the restroom, came back. Hopkins Cornell is on the TV. He did it. He went and got it. So we watched the second half. And as the game wore on and Hopkins was staying competitive, it's like Hopkins can win this game, you know? And then when they were late and then in overtime, I'm like, just give the ball to Collison. And Owen said the same thing. You know, he's played against Collison 3 years now. And sure enough, you get the ball 16, he makes a play, finds Jimmy Ayers, game over. Hopkins advances to the quarterfinals. They will face a Notre Dame team that is just really efficient. The one player that I'm really impressed with, his development, is the goaltender, Ricciardelli. Early in the Jacksonville game, the Dolphins won the first faceoff, came down, and they kept getting shot clock resets. They took 3-4 shots on Ricciardelli, and he saved them all, and they were all quality shots. And then Notre Dame goes down and scores. And it's just like, all right. And then it just went downhill from there for the Dolphins. He is really developed into the backbone of that defense. Everybody talks about Sean Light, and you need to. But Ricciardelli's really developed into a Liam Entman type. I'm not saying he's Liam Entman by any stretch, but the way he played in that game, rebounding from that loss to Virginia in the ACC tournament, reminded me of Entman type goaltending. Will they get it this weekend? I'm not quite sure. Obviously, their defense, Notre Dame's, is the headliner. Offensively, they just kind of piece things together. They take turns at having great games, whereas Hopkins, they are first midfield dominant. They are first midfield dominant. The way that Rawson, Collison, and English go, that's how the team's going to go, and that's where the game will be decided.
I agree on the first midfield part in particular. In the fourth quarter up at Cornell, I think it was a tie game, and coming out of a timeout, Hopkins put in the second midfield and nothing. Yeah, no offense to the second midfield. I think they have good individual pieces. I love watching Jamison Smith. You know, he's just sort of a role player who all of a sudden has scored some really big goals, two goals against Penn State. You know, he's has scored some big goals this season. Collison impressed me watching him in person. I don't know why I hadn't really caught on to this before, but, you know, every time he gets the ball, he draws so much attention. And that was what Jimmy Ayers said after the game when he talked about his winning goal. He said, I had the easy part. Collie draws so much attention. And when he watched the replay, Collison comes up, he gets a step on the LSM stall, or close, but LSM in this case, and he just draws the slide. And Collison, to his credit, he looks first at Rawson on the crease, and that drew the defender away from Ayers, and then he passed to Ayers. To have that vision in that moment of an overtime game, I was very impressed by that. And remember, he does not lead the team in assists. Brooks English does. Brooks English, I think, has 23, and Collison and Rosser are both at that 14 or 15 mark. Josh Hopkins talked a lot after the Cornell game of wanting to get their shooters their hands free. You know, and Hunter Chauvet, with his hands free, is an unbelievable shooter. He said, we need hands-free shots, and Cornell was not giving them the hands-free shots. And so I think some of that will be Notre Dame. I know talking to the Georgetown guys, they were very impressed with Notre Dame's short stick D middies. And they thought, you know, having lost Ramsey and having lost some of the guys the past couple of years, they didn't think Notre Dame would be as good at short stick D-mid as they were. So to me, that's going to be very interesting. You know, can Johns Hopkins win a matchup, force a slide, and can they one of their kids get a hands-free shot? Richard Daly, I agree with you, Dixie. He's a big kid. You know, I wasn't that impressed with him last year. Like, obviously, he was good. I didn't think he was great. He's gotten much better this year. And again, because he takes up so much of the cage, much like Leon Nentman did. You know, again, not comparing the two necessarily, but they are similar in that respect. And I really like this Schwitzenberg kid, the second defenseman to light. I think he has good feet, a little bit like Georgetown and their 1-2 punch, which we'll talk about later. Then the last thing I will say about Notre Dame is that a friend who was at the Georgetown-Notre Dame, remember they moved it indoors and it wasn't on TV, and a buddy who was there said, man, Notre Dame has so many two-handed middies who can run, who can dodge, and who can shoot. And I do, you know, I think Johns Hopkins has short 60 middies who are very good at drawing cost turnovers. You know, I think Reese Chico leaves the team and caused turnovers as a short 60 middie.
Ground balls and caused turnovers as a short 60 middie. Yeah,
Reese Chico. And I think that'll be and the last thing I'll say about Luke Martin, talking to him after the game, and one of the things he said was that the game plan against Cornell was to clog the passing lanes. It was something that Jamison Kester and Cohen, the assistant coaches, had noticed, that Cornell likes to dodge down one side and then switch the field to the other side quickly. And so Luke Martin was playing off his man more often than not, Firth, and so he was deep enough in that to get in his way, passing lane. I thought it was such an interesting idea that I had never really thought about. And if Sunday in the Georgetown UVA game, UVA did something similar. Do you remember coming out of a timeout and they were double teaming the ball, and Lars told the second double teamer, said, stand back a little bit because he's going to try to pass it. And the deeper you are, the better chance you have of knocking it down. And he did. So I think that is something I'm going to keep my eye on. Is this going to become kind of a trend where you give your guy three or four steps because you know he's going to pass, and you can get your stick in the passing lane much better than if you're uptight against him?
You know, that's a good point you make, and I saw it later in the season. Guys were really getting down the alley with ease.
Yes.
And guys started to shoot the ball. And I'm like, thank God, because it's just so mechanical these days and so scripted. Okay, I'm going to start my dodge down the alley. I'm going to bang it through to X. And then guys were like, you're going to give me all this space? I'm taking the shot, you know. Mm-hmm. So I hope that – I haven't seen it much, because defense has been a little tougher last weekend. But to your point, yeah, maybe we're especially dodging from behind, you know, getting above goal line extended, maybe give them a little bit more room to operate with. But up top, you give me the alley, man, I'm going to let that fly. I don't care if it's 10 seconds into the shot clock. You know, if I get a good look on cage unfettered, I'm taking it.
And the other thing about Luke Martin, too, is that he guarded Firth, and Firth only took 3 shots. You know, that's a Twarton finalist with 50-something goals entering the game. And his only goal was that extra man goal right before halftime on the slam dunk from Goldstein. And you guys might appreciate this, but after the game, Luke Martin, when I interviewed him, he had 2 bananas. The Blue Jay Banana Group gave him 2 because he had been so good. And I thought, I don't think I've ever seen that before. Usually they're pretty stingy. You get 1 regardless, but Luke Martin got 2. So that shows you how well he played.
All right, so Notre Dame is a 2.5 goal favorite, as I mentioned, the biggest spread of the game. It also has the lowest over-under. 20.5 goals is the lowest of the 4 games this week. What does Johns Hopkins need to do to get a win? What's their game plan?
You know, for most of this year and last year, they've been so good at sort of, Dixie, I think you call it a sky whammy. You know, if the shot clock is between 60 and 35, they give you the sky whammy, but they're not going to shoot that. They really like to work the clock. They really like to look for their matchups, constant off-ball movement. And once they get something they like and it's under 30 seconds on the shot clock, they'll say, okay, this is go time. And if they don't get something they like and it's under 15 seconds, that's when they give it to Collison or English and say, okay, you guys take it over. We didn't get what we wanted. But I think that's part of the reason the over-under is so low, is because Hopkins does tend to bleed the shot clock, and Notre Dame, you know, the attack isn't super high powered the way it has been in the past with the Kavanaughs. Iago, the attackman from Air Force, is a super accurate shooter, and Miller, I think, is super accurate too. So they're effective. I think both offenses are more effective than they are explosive, and that would be. And I think both defenses are pretty good too. So that would be my guess on that one.
I think I already said. I mean, this game for Hopkins depends on how the first midfield performs. Like that's the group that's going to carry them through. With that being said, they need to spark transition, which I don't think is as robust as it was with Kilrain. No one, you know, Carson Brown runs the field well, but doesn't really have the offensive stick that Kilrain has. They're going to need Jelinus to have a solid day. They weren't giving up shots to Cornell. You know, it's not like he wasn't making saves. You know, they weren't giving up shots. But Notre Dame's going to get their opportunities. He needs to be big. And then, you know, it's like John Tillman described to us in preparation for the Hopkins-Maryland game when Kark and I did it. He's like, they're so effective. They're so deadly in the first 15 seconds of their offense because of their sub games. And we saw it at Homewood Field that day. I mean, I think they scored their first two out of the first three goals were in unsettled, winning the substitution game, coming on, creating an uneven situation. So if Hopkins can check all those boxes, there's a good chance that they'll be in Charlottesville.
All right, Christian, you and I have to pick these games. I'm going to take Notre Dame straight up to win.
Wearing the Hopkins shirt, he's taking the Irish.
Yeah, every time I pick against the Blue Jays, they win.
There you go.
So I'm going to keep going all the way through Memorial Day, hopefully. So I'm going to take the Irish.
Yeah, I have Notre Dame somewhere in the, you know, 12-9, 13-9 type performance. I have Notre Dame, too.
So you like Notre Dame and the over. Moving on to our second game. This is the third matchup in 2026 of these ACC foes when the third-seeded North Carolina Tar Heels, 13-4 on the season, will take on sixth-seed Syracuse, who's 12-5. Again, this will be at Hofstra and Shewhart Stadium. This game's 2:30. UNC is a 1.5 goal favorite. The over-under is 23.5. UNC has beaten Cuse twice, 14-9 on April 4th in Chapel Hill, and then again 12-10 on May 1st in the ACC semifinals. So they've beaten them twice in the last month. It's the third time the charm for the Cuse, Christian?
I think it is. First, I have to say, just on a lacrosse sort of fan level, it's incredible to me that either Joey Spallina or Don Petromala will not make the Final Four as a senior, or championship weekend, whatever you want to call it. Like, to me, that's a very human kind of, I'm going to be watching, I'm covering this game for Inside Lacrosse, and that's what I'm really going to be watching, sort of the senior versus senior, because they're so terribly accomplished, and one of them is not going to get to the sport's largest stage. And I'm grateful to PLL that these guys continue playing on some kind of spotlight so they don't disappear completely. But that really is compelling to me. Which of those seniors, and in particular Dom versus Spallina, which one will not make it to championship weekend? I have Syracuse winning this, because although someone did tell me, someone who knows more about lacrosse than I do, which doesn't narrow it down very much, but someone who knows way more than I do said, look, Syracuse's goalie had the second half of his life. They won against Yale. They won every single faceoff against Yale, and they won by one goal. And so, you know, Syracuse, I know there are some people who are like, the big games, the Syracuse, they always show up. I don't know. But I feel like their senior class will get them through, even though I think Carolina's going to win just about every single faceoff, which will be a problem. And I have no idea if Owen Duffy's playing or not. But I think Syracuse wins this.
Anytime you have to beat a team three times in a season, it's a challenge. And this game, apparently there's only going to be a couple station wagon full of Carolina fans, according to a writer at Inside Lacrosse. So the Heels won't have a whole lot of support. But I mean, you know, look, it's this is a de facto home game for Syracuse. They're comfortable at Hofstra. They went to their last championship weekend last year, beat Princeton, but also North Carolina won in 2021 when they beat Rutgers at Hofstra to go to the national semifinals and championship weekend. Owen Duffy, his status is in the air. Not sure if he's going to play or not. I think we can be confident that Kent Goode will get the start again in net for North Carolina, and he was solid last weekend. He didn't need to be spectacular. He made some early saves, kept all UAlbany at bay, and you know Carolina was able to win that game in dominant fashion. Brady Wambach is a beast, and he was a difference maker in the ACC semifinal at a period where Carolina was struggling, and he scored two goals right before halftime, I believe, to really shift the momentum in that game. When you look at Syracuse, they can be physical, they can be a little reckless, but they're so gifted and they're so athletic. Everybody's going to point to, I think, Syracuse is 4-5 out away from the dome this year, something along those
That's
lines.
Right.
And then 8-0 at home in the dome. Does that play a factor? I'm not sure. We'll find out. But this should be a great crowd. It looks like it's going to be great weather in Hempstead. I mean, look, man, you got Notre Dame, Hopkins, Carolina, Syracuse in a quarterfinal at the same place. It's going to be lights out, and looking forward to this one.
Quickly, Dixie, going to your point, you know, in my book, Wyatt Nust last year in the quarterfinal between Cornell and Richmond only made, I think, five saves and didn't make any, the Cornell goalie, didn't make any in the final 27 or 28 minutes of the game. And he said he had a lot of trouble picking up the ball. Just even in the walkthrough the day before, he just was not seeing the ball against that backdrop. I guess it's metallic on one side, and the other side is that building that's kind of beige. And I'm curious, you know, these are goalies who are going to have to adjust to that, because your point about the Carrier Dome, I think opposing goalies have trouble seeing the ball in the Carrier Dome. I wonder if that might make a difference, especially with a goalie like Carolina's who hasn't played a whole lot.
Do we have any idea, indication of what the ticket sales look like?
No, that's a good question. I think last year it was right around 8,500, about 9,000. I would suspect it'll be pretty robust this year. Hopkins does, I think, tend to draw pretty well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great lineup. That is a great lineup of teams.
I do know that trying to find a hotel this time last week, there were several properties that were sold out. And then after this weekend, like Sunday night, a lot of them were open again. So you have to imagine the Cornell fans, the UAlbany fans, the Yale fans, the teams that lost probably gave up their rooms or canceled their rooms. But
it's possible.
That really didn't
I think the crowd, hopefully if Carolina brings three station wagons full, that'll boost the crowd. I think three station wagons and a golf cart, I think that'll really boost the crowd.
Maybe they'll do that.
I think
are you going to be on site, Christian, for the game?
Yes. Oh, okay. I'll be there.
Yeah, make sure you swing by the Carolina tailgate.
I'm leaving that in there. So this game for me, UNC is a 1.5-goal favorite. I lean towards UNC, but it comes down to whether Owen Duffy plays or not. If Owen Duffy plays, I'm going to take the Heels to win their third one, make it to the Final Four. If he's a no-go, then I think Syracuse has a real shot to advance to the Final Four. Christian, who do you got?
Syracuse. Although I'm in the minority, I've asked a number of people about this game, and most have Carolina winning in that 14-11 range. I have Syracuse 13-12.
Great doubleheader on Saturday, and it may only get better on Sunday from the University of Delaware's Delaware Stadium in my hometown of Newark, Delaware. Number 8, Penn State. We'll take on the top seed Princeton Tigers. Penn State enters the game 10-5. They're the Big Ten champions. Last week, they beat the Army Black Knights. Princeton is coming in a win, an easy win over Marist in their first round game. This game will kick off the day at noon on Sunday. Again, all these games are on ESPNU. Princeton is a 1.5-goal favorite. The over-under is 22.5. Fans will remember in a much talked about early season game, Penn State, who had two games under its belt at the time, beat Princeton in the Tigers season opener 13-7 back on Valentine's Day. Princeton's only lost once since then. Dixie, What are your thoughts on this one?
Look, honestly, nothing against Hofstra. I wish I was going to Delaware. It's a much easier drive, much easier commute. But regardless, I was pleasantly surprised that Hunter Aquino played last weekend against Army. The way he looked at the end of the Big Ten championship game, I didn't think he was going to be able to play. But he played, and he played well. Him and Andrew Beard make Penn State very different. Aquino can play anywhere on the offensive end, behind the cage, on the wing, up top. He'll never leave the field. And then Andrew Beard, with his speed, I remember watching him in high school, and he was a really, really good player. I don't remember him having that kind of straight line speed to get underneath the defense and then cut it back up the way that he has over the last few weeks. You know, and then you talk about Ian Tuano and Lehman. You got the the tandem at the faceoff with Baldwin and Gills. I mean, this is a really, really good team that, Matt Kinnear wrote a good piece in Inside Lacrosse this week talking about how the head scratching losses that Penn State has absorbed this year made this run possible. And they got great wins. Freshman goaltender, how does Preston Hawkins respond to the biggest game of his career against a Princeton team that is just, I just feel like they have studs everywhere on the field. Even on the defensive end this year with Stahl, the way he's developed, and then Ryan Kroduk between the pipes, and they face off well, and then offensively they just play at such a high rate. So I expect this to be, we might get the game that we thought we were going to have back in February. Remember, Dan, we were talking about this game being like an over, like the line being like 29.5, the over under, and it was 13-7. We might get that more high octane, more, really, really robust offensive output this time around.
I think this will be the best of the quarterfinals. You know, when I went through my predictions, there was the one I said, well, one of these is clearly not going to go to plan. And I think this is the one. I think Penn State, I think Dixie, you and Joe Beninati in the Big Ten title game said, when this team is clicking, they can win the national title. That has always stuck with me. He said, yeah, they're good enough to absolutely be the last one standing on Memorial Day. The way their season has gone reminds me a little bit of that Roger Angel line, that they were about as consistent as a malaria victims' temperatures, just kind of always swaying up and down. You couldn't really get a read on them one way or the other. I think this will be a very good game because I think Penn State matches up well with Princeton. I think Princeton is pretty athletic, especially for, the Ivy League team. I think Penn State can match up well with them. Alex Ross, I think, is an unbelievable defenseman, and I think he can really erase some people. And again, as you note, Dixie, there's so much depth there. You know, if the one faceoff guy isn't working, go to the other. If Aquino isn't working on attack against Stahl, bring him to midfield. You know, maybe Stahl goes up there, and then you can get some mismatches. I think Princeton wins, but I think it's going to be a game that's very, very, very close up until the final 5 minutes.
The line again is 1.5 points, Princeton's favorite of the over under 22.5. Dixie, I think that 22.5 is a little bit low, and it will be higher, but I think the line is wrong on this one. I think Princeton's the best team in the country. They're out for revenge, and I think they're gonna win by more than a goal or two. That's my take. So Princeton, for both Sweezy and I, pick in the Tigers.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I think I'm going to go 14-11 or 15-11 final. But again, I think it's 11-10 or 11-11 with 5 minutes left.
Yeah. Okay. And in the final game of the weekend, a game that I don't think a lot of people saw this, is two unseeded teams who will play. Georgetown, 11-4 on season, will play the Duke Blue Devils, who are 10-4. Again, 230 ESPNU. Duke's a 1.5 goal favorite. 23.5 is the over-under, which is tied for the highest of the weekend with that Syracuse-UNC game. Georgetown, Big East champs, won 8 in a row. Duke is the at-large selection who defeated number 4 seed Richmond 14-12 on Saturday night in a stunning game. Duke leads this series 24-7 all-time. They've played a lot. But the Hoyas are 2-0 all-time against the Blue Devils in the NCAA tournament, including a 16-12 win last year in the first round in Durham.
And also, the only time Georgetown ever made the Final Four, they beat Duke in the quarterfinal at Hofstra in 99. I was there for Washington Post.
And speaking of Hofstra, Kevin Warren will play his mentor, John Donowski, his coach at Hofstra, in this game as the pupil meets the teacher. Once again, I'll let you start, Christian.
I have been fortunate enough to be around Georgetown a little bit recently, and I'm so impressed by their buy-in and their want to. You know, their sideline is completely, when you watch their games, I suspect it comes across on TV too, but when you watch their games, their sideline, so much energy from the sideline, and they're getting kind of little contributions. You know, even on man down defense, Matthew Rienzo, a sophomore, three in the Big East semifinal, in the Big East final, in the first round against Duke, he only plays man-down defense, and he has jumped in front of shots. He injured his rib rather badly in one of those three games, and it's such a juice play when he jumps in front of that shot, turns his back, you know, ball goes out of bounds, and Georgetown wins the runout, and the entire sideline goes crazy. And this is just some simple man-down thing, but this is what they do. They have a senior on the team, a short safety midi who had played well, named James Coretta, who, after scoring his first career goal on senior day against St. John's in mid-April, was diagnosed with cancer 2 days later. And so he is now in treatment. He's not around the team anymore. But I think that has galvanized them. I know that he does not want to be any part of a storyline. He sort of politely requested not to be, and I completely understand that and I respect it. But I will say, I think that something like that can really galvanize a team. And on the back of their helmets for the Virginia game, they had on one side their own number, and on the other side, Coretta's number 18 with a purple cancer awareness ribbon in the background. So I do think this is a team that's playing well. The guy for me that has made the difference, the Connor brothers, obviously are amazing, but I really like this James Schubert. He was hurt last year, came back this year. He played an amazing role as a freshman in 24. He's very twitchy, as the kids say. He's tall. He's from Lake Braddock High School in Northern Virginia, one of the public schools. And I think he's an incredible athlete. I really like watching him play. I think he's a major matchup issue because you already have to devote so much to the two Connor brothers. I like this Georgetown team. And they have the 1-2 punch on defense with Plath and Banks.
What does Christian love more than Navy and Cornell? Georgetown. Georgetown. It's got his Patrick Ewing underoos on.
Facts.
So, first things first, Georgetown and Virginia combined for 43 turnovers. This was an ugly game last Sunday night, but Georgetown gritted it out. And you know, look, I don't wager anymore on any sport, let alone lacrosse. But going into this, I'm like, man, I should take money line Georgetown, because I thought the Hoyas were going to win that game. You know, Dan and I, we talked last weekend, particularly when you fill out your basketball March Madness brackets, you can fall into a trap. Like, let's say Wisconsin wins the Big Ten, and you're like, oh, Wisconsin, they're going to the Final Four. I think people really felt that way about Virginia. They won the ACC tournament. They're all in. McCabe got snubbed. Should have been for the Tuoriton. Virginia showed us who they were and who they've been all season long. Erratic, unpredictable. And, you know, now their season is over. I got to say, too, I'm ready to quit Twitter or X. There are so many nudniks out there with lacrosse opinions these days. And it is disgusting that there was a rumor going around that Lars Tiffany was going to be fired. I mean, don't people understand that? I mean, these are he's got a family, and these are players that play for a coach and, you know, assistants and stuff like that. You start rumors like that, man, it's just, and that's like tip of the iceberg with some of the stuff I've seen this year on social media. It really is. These hot takes are really damaging to a lot of folks. But with that being said, Georgetown was very impressed with their heart and their desire and the way that how hard they played. And they play hard all the time for Kevin Warren. They take their personality from their head coach, who's a guy that just runs up and down the sideline. Sometimes he falls. Sometimes he's able to keep his feet. Guy had big grass stain on his back, you know, by what, end of the second quarter the other night. He's got his glasses. You know, who puts readers or whatever they are, like on your collar? Like, who doesn't wear the readers? I can see sunglasses, but like readers for a guy that's, as he would say, is that athletic, getting up and down the sidelines during a game. But I agree with you, Christian. I feel like the reliance on the Connor brothers has lessened over the last couple of weeks with guys like Jack Ransom stepping up and Mason Natty, and you mentioned Jack Schubert taking some scoring pressure off of the Connor brothers. Anderson Moore, I was talking to Mike Preston this week of the Baltimore Sun, and he said, you know, are you surprised at Anderson Moore and Jimmy McCool's play this weekend? And I'm like, well, look, they're both outstanding goalies. I'm a little bit more surprised at McCool because he's been so streaky this season. But, you know, Andy Moore has been pretty consistent all year long. And I think, you know, Georgetown is no longer a secret. I think the only real dose that people got of Georgetown this year was when they got whooped in the dome by Syracuse about 6 weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So, wow, a lot about Georgetown. Let's focus on Duke. I know a lot of people are screaming bloody murder that the Blue Devils got Richmond, or Richmond got the Blue Devils. I mean, that's kind of the way it works out. When you look at last year, Ohio State, Notre Dame, and the Buckeyes' best season in program history with respect to their Big Ten competition. I know 2017, they made it to the national championship, but last year they won their first Big Ten tournament championship and regular season title, and they get Notre Dame. They get bounced at home in the first round of the NCAA. Let's not forget that we're still really small potatoes. As much as this sport means to us, it's still small potatoes. It's an Olympic sport in the eyes of the NCAA. So when you have a team like Richmond against a team like Duke that did not have a very Duke-like year, and guess what? They can bus to Richmond, no flight. Let's put the Blue Devils at Richmond and give a lot of credit to John Donowski's team, down by 3 goals in the fourth quarter, to be able to come back and really take control of that game and win that game. I mean, just a tough, tough team. And it's going to be a really difficult game for Georgetown in this one. I mean, look at you have a team from Duke that if Carolina would have beaten them, their season is done. They're over. Now they're one game away from going back to championship weekend, something they could not accomplish Brennan O'Neill's senior year. You know, let that sink in for a second. You know, Duke has some great players on that roster, but there's no Brennan O'Neill's out there on that team. And they're one win away from going back to the big show.
I have Georgetown winning. I like this Duke team. I love the defensive midfield. I love their face-off, Girard. But I there's something about this Georgetown team I really immensely like, and I do think that they'll win by a couple. I think somewhere in the 12 to 10 range.
I'm with you, Sweezy. I'm going to take the boys too, but it's going to take a big effort from our guy, Ted Moon, who coaches the face-off guys for the Hoyas. Duke faces off around 57%. The Hoyas are around 46%. Hoyas are going to have to win some face-offs to get it done. But I think they do, and I'm going to take the Hoyas also. All right, 4 great games, 2 on Saturday, 2 on Sunday, 2 and 2:30 are the time slots. Make your plans. It doesn't get much better than this. These are important games with great teams and great players and great coaches. It's what every fan dreams of. And the dream for 4 of these teams to get to a Final Four and championship weekend is right there for the taking. And we'll see who does it. All right, guys, time for the give and go. During the conference tournament weekend, a friend of the pod, Craig McMichael, writes the weekend watch for the Inside Lacrosse. Texted with me during, I think it was the Vermont was playing, so it must have been the America East tournament. And he couldn't get over how slick the Vermont uniforms look. Those green and gold uniforms, he loves them. And he prompted a discussion of who has the best, worst, and maybe the most underrated, unheralded uniforms in all of college lacrosse. And I thought I would ask you two. Both of you are... you know, I mean, just look at you, how well you're dressed. You guys know fashion. You know
yeah, what I'm a real like. Fashion plate.
But I thought I'd bring this to you guys. You also watch a lot of college lacrosse, and you see a lot of different teams throughout the season. What are your favorite uniforms? We don't have to throw out the worst, unless there's one that you really...
No, I'll throw out the worst. Richmond and High Point.
Okay.
Sorry, Adidas. Those are brutal.
You don't like the Adidas kits?
No. Mm-mm.
Doesn't
they're like shirts. They're not jerseys. They're shirts.
Does Bryant also Adidas?
I think you might be right. Yeah. No thank you.
Okay. Well, who do you like, Dix? What's your style? Like, what teams, combinations?
I can also tell you some other uniforms that I don't like that I used to really like begrudgingly. I don't like Syracuse uniforms anymore. I used to love the porthole mesh and even, you know, the white with the trim on the sleeves, the orange and the blue, and the Syracuse was in orange and blue. Now, like, their home jerseys just say orange, and then they have the dark blue ones that have the cursive Syracuse. I'm just I love the old school Syracuse uniforms, not a fan of the current ones. Virginia's, depending upon which one they wear, they used to have really legit slick uniforms, and they kind of go through a phase. They're not terrible, but they're not my favorite. I do not like the Princeton blacks. I just think they're too plain. They don't have any outline anymore, where the old ones, even when they were black, they would be like orange numerals and orange letters with white outline. Now they're just kind of like, you know, on their own. Not a huge fan of that. But the uniforms that I like, I mean, Hopkins uniforms are always on point. You know, they're always legit. Carolina, I mean, you want to talk about old school. The Carolina port mesh back in the day were legendary. But I really like, especially their home ones. They're just so clean. The white and white are really cool. Christian, why don't you go ahead? I'm gonna think of some more. I know I'm going to noodle on it for a second. I know I have others that I really like.
So I am a big, and I know, Dixie, you're a San Diego Chargers fan or whatever city they're in now, but I am a big triple mismatch guy. I love when the shorts, jersey, and helmet are a different color. You know, the old Chargers with the yellow pants, the white shirt, and the blue helmet. And so I actually was watching D3. I was watching the RIT Salisbury game, won by RIT in overtime, in a quarterfinal on Sunday. And I love the RIT, a little very similar to Princeton, orange and black, but the way they do it, they had white shorts, orange jerseys, and I believe black helmet. And I loved it. I was like, oh, triple mismatch. I am all day on the triple mismatch. So any team that does that, you know, if Johns Hopkins, if they do the they have a pretty good triple mismatch in their closet as well. I've always liked the Columbia blue. I don't love the freaking Carolina blue that Hopkins wears. I really wish they would go back to that one that's just a little bit darker shade of blue like they did in the 80s. And I think Hopkins pulled it out for one of the Duke games when Rabel was there and got blown out like 17-6, and we haven't seen it since. But I would like to see them go back to a little bit of a darker shade of blue on the road for Hopkins. And I do have to say, you've chided me about this, but I do like the cherry red of Princeton and Rutgers. And that cherry red is so classic to me. So those are my favorites. Least favorites, I have to think about that one for a minute. I don't like the uniform. You know what? I don't like, and Colgate used to do this, I do not like the uniforms where you can't really read the numbers, and I think it's, you know, obfuscation for the films. Colgate used to have, like, red numbers or red jerseys with, like, red numbers and, like, a little white outline around the numbers, and you couldn't read it at all. And I always thought, it was like, do you have to be that cheap to, like, try to get an advantage? So I didn't like those old Colgate uniforms at all. I like Bucknell. I like blue and orange. I also like Bucknell.
Yeah. So other ones that I really like, I like Georgetown, those blues.
Yeah.
That they wore the other night. Those are legit. And then the other ones that I love are Penn State's. Now that they've gone to the just the Penn State across the chest, and then if they're wearing blue, the two white stripes on the sleeves. If they're wearing white, two blue stripes on the sleeve, but those are clean. Like, those are legit, the Penn State uniforms. You want to talk about some crazy jerseys. This is going back, gosh, 15, maybe 20 years. I was doing a game at Towson with Scott Garceau, and we were all the way up top, and Towson wore white jerseys with pale yellow numbers and no outline. And Scott couldn't see the numbers, and it was a noon game. Bright sunny day, could not read the numbers. It's crazy. See, I'm with you. Where you like the jerseys where it pops. I don't like
yes.
I used to really like Denver's uniforms. I don't like their new design as much as I like the old ones.
All right, my favorites.
Yeah. We forgot you were here.
Again, I tried not to pick Hopkins, but they're like the Oregon football of lacrosse in terms of their different combinations that they can put together with different helmets. I mean, they probably have more helmets than anyone, it seems like. I don't love the all-white Hopkins uniforms, but just about any other combination, I love. They always look sweet. And I do. We're talking about the Nag Blue Jay. The white helmet they have with the Nag Blue Jay on it is just perfect. I saw they're going to pull out some new blue helmets, Columbia Blue helmets, the new Cascades with the white, like the this like the new Blue Jay on the side. They look pretty sweet for the quarterfinals. I love Georgetown, but I like the gray jerseys with the blue shorts. I don't know what it is about their gray jerseys with the blue numbers. I think they look really good.
What I don't like about the grays, I like their appearance, but I don't like it just says Hoyas. I like it when the school is spelled out.
Isn't that the old thing? If you're at home, it says the nickname, and if you're on the road, it says the school.
That's how baseball used to do it. I know that's a baseball thing for sure. You know, that was a gripe with the Orioles for such a long time. Their home and their road jerseys both said Orioles and did not say Baltimore.
And then my third one would be when Notre Dame wears the all blue with the gold helmets.
Those are pretty. Those are nice.
Those are nice. And then every once in a while they'll throw in the green color scheme at Notre Dame with the gold helmets. That it just looks it's classic. Love it.
Anything else? I do miss the jerseys that had the names running perpendicular. Remember Cornell had that and Navy had that in the 80s. It would say Navy down the side instead of across the chest. I liked that. Someone should bring that back.
That was old.
Yes, exactly. 80s.
I think Al McGuire, the basketball coach at Marquette, had the vertical
and the chevrons down the side of both of them. Yeah, like DePaul used to have to. Love that. Marquette had that, remember, for lacrosse. They had the little checkerboard thing down the sides.
Yeah, and isn't that what Carolina does? They have sort of the Argyle on the shorts.
Yeah, the Argyle, I think, running down.
It's pretty sweet.
I like that. Yeah.
I've always liked that. It looks good. All right, that seems like a good place to stop. A reminder that the D-Fly and Dixie podcast is brought to you by Simplicity Group. Simplicity Group is a leading financial products distribution firm that specializes in providing best-in-class insurance, investment, and business development solutions. To learn more, visit simplicitygroup.com. Special thanks to this week's guest, Christian Sweezy. Go out and find his new book. And do us a favor. Like us on your favorite podcast app. Leave a review. But most importantly, tell a friend. Share the love. It's free. We know you're going to be doing some tailgating this weekend when you're watching these games. This is a great – if you're not listening to us while you're driving to the game, you can put it on during the tailgate in between your
favorite station wagons. the two station wagons that Carolina fans can listen to it.
Give us a shout out on Twitter and Instagram at dflyanddixie or find us, send us an email at dflyanddixie@gmail.com. We're running out of time on the season, everybody. Thanks for listening. And as always, enjoy the games.